Ronnie rise to his feet to stand on the seat, his head hanging low, his mouth open as great convulsive movements rolled up and down his body.
"Lay down, Ronnie,"
Lillian cried as she hung over the front seat.
"Step on, Miss Julia. Let's get him home."
Too late, for after a few nauseating, rolling contractions, Ronnie emptied his stomach all over the footwell of my luxury car. Then, with a great sigh, he lay back down and closed his eyes, seemingly at ease and at peace, as who wouldn't be after such a clearing out of the system. The air was another matter. Lillian and I drove home with all windows open in spite of the chilly weather. Quickly getting Ronnie out of the car, but not without his stepping where he shouldn't have, we hosed off his feet, dried them, and led him into the kitchen. "Lillian," I said, "if you'll find another blanket or something for him to lie down on, I'll get the one out of the car and put it in the trash. Do we have any air freshener?" Between the two of us, Lillian and I started the medication protocol, following the chart that Dr. Marsh had given us. He'd been right. Ronnie loved the massage that went along with the eardrops. He moaned with pleasure as I rubbed the medicine in. I scrubbed my hands for 10 minutes afterward.
"'Lo, Miss Julia,' Lillian said as she looked over the diet pamphlet. "'To fix all this, I got to go to the grocery store and the drug store and maybe get a doctor's prescription.'
I looked over her shoulder at the instructions. "'My word! Lean hamburger, lamb, rice, organic butter, wheat germ, calcium nitrate, yogurt, ginger, carrots, collards, of all things, and that's just a start. What in the world is turmeric? Lillian, forget all this. I'll pass it on to Helen. For now, fix him a mixture of hamburger meat and rice. Then throw in an egg or two or whatever leftovers you have in the refrigerator. But no beans." Ronnie twitched his ears and sighed again. Then he stretched out on the fresh coverlet in the corner of the kitchen and, without moving his head, flicked his eyes from one to the other of us as we discussed his special diet.
"Yes'm. I spec he'll eat most anything empty as he is."
She went to the refrigerator, opened the door to look in, then, as she straightened up, said,
"There's a light blinking on the telephone, Miss Julia."
"Oh, my," I said, hearing Hazel Marie's message to call her as soon as I came in. "What now?" When I returned Hazel Marie's call, her first words came tumbling out. "Oh, Miss Julia, you won't believe it, but they're over there right now with a man from Jason's Remodeling Services. I know because that's what's painted on his truck that's parked out front. They're starting to fix up that house, which means they'll be moving in before long. Can't Binky do anything to stop them?"
"I don't know, but I'm going to find out. Just hold on, Hazel Marie. We barely started."
Chapter 12 Binky, however, was in court, where she seemed to spend more time than she did in her office, so I had to leave an urgent message for her to call me. Even exercising the patience of Job, I had to wait until supper time before hearing from her. "Binky," I said, "Hazel Marie tells me that those Homes for Teens people are already remodeling the Cochran house. What is going on? Have they responded to your letter?"
"I've not heard from them, Miss Julia," she said, "but nothing has changed. They cannot use that house for their stated purpose, so maybe they're updating it to put it on the market again."
A great feeling of relief swept over me at that possibility. Wouldn't that be grand? Ask around, Binky. See who might be handling the sale. I might be interested.
"Oh, I don't think you want to get into the rental business. Too many headaches."
"Why, Binky, I'm already in the rental business up to my neck. What's another house or two?"
"Well, but residential rentals are a whole nother ballgame from commercial rentals. I wouldn't recommend it for you, but, of course, do as you like."
Thinking to myself, "I certainly will," I urged her to pursue the status of the Cochran house and let me know. So with that anxiety hanging overhead, I set myself to medicating Ronnie, wondering all the while why in the world I hadn't left well enough alone.
Just by trying to alleviate a suffering animal, I had bound myself to an every 4-hour schedule that would play havoc with my time, to say nothing of my sleep. I had called Helen with an update on Ronnie's condition that afternoon, hoping that she might tell me to bring him home so she could administer his medicine through the night. She didn't. Instead, she had eagerly accepted my half-hearted offer to care for him during his medical crisis. I can't say I blamed her, except that she was the one who'd made the arrangement to care for Thurlow, for which she was being well paid. And as far as I was concerned, caring for Thurlow included caring not only for his house, but also for his dog. When Lloyd came in from school, he was delighted to find that we had a house guest. Wanting to encourage him in the care and feeding of animals, I let him administer the second application of eardrops around 6 o'clock. Ronnie tried to respond to the boy. There is a natural affinity between boys and dogs, you know. But his efforts availed him little. Ronnie, that is, soon lay back down as lethargic as ever. I waited the 4 hours for the third application before going to bed. When Lloyd and I retired for the night, we left Ronnie, full from a rice and ground beef casserole, and properly walked afterward, apparently quite pleased with his temporary room and board. As I turned out the downstairs lights, Ronnie was lying peacefully in the corner of the kitchen, and after Lloyd had petted him for a while, we'd gone upstairs where I set the clock for the ungodly hour of 2 a.m. Even though I was dreading the trek downstairs in a cold house in the middle of the night, Ronnie had foreseen the problem. When the alarm went off at 2, I swung my feet out of bed and landed on Ronnie, who'd transferred himself to my bedside. I didn't know if he'd craved company, mine in particular, or whether he would have preferred Lloyd's. It was an unanswerable question under the circumstances, for Lloyd's door had been closed and mine had not. Whichever it was a settled fact that Ronnie had grown accustomed to the application of eardrops. When that dog saw me reach for the bottles, he lay right down on his side and held his head still while his eyes rolled up in expectation. And when I massaged the medicine into his ears, a low, luxuriating moan issued from his throat, much as happened with me when Sam gave me a back rub. When the alarm went off at 6 for the next application, I decided I might as well stay up, especially because Ronnie started sniffing around my bedroom as if searching for a spot. I took him downstairs and outside for a walk around the yard, nearly freezing in the process, and hoping no early morning runners would notice my bathrobe. That's the one big problem with having a dog in the house. They have to be let outside on a regular basis. Or, as in Ronnie's case, put on a leash and taken outside because my yard wasn't fenced. Still, there is something quite touching about having a dog make every step you make and rest his head on your feet when you seat yourself, and I must say that with Ronnie in the house at night, even with Lloyd there, there was a double dose of comfort. No burglar would dare try our doors with that huge animal on guard. His size alone would deter the most determined invader. And it occurred to me that if Thurlow could be persuaded to let him go, Ronnie would be a sizable deterrent in Hazel Marie's house if, despite Binky's assurances to the contrary, a horde of potential mischief-makers moved in next door.
"Miss Julia?"
"What? What is it?" I nearly dropped the phone at the sound of Hazel Marie's distress call. It was mid-morning that Saturday, and Ronnie and I were resting in between eardrop applications.
"J.D. got in early this morning. I couldn't believe it because I wasn't expecting him till later today. But here he came, and I wasn't ready for him."
"Well, Hazel Marie, he is your husband. What do you need to do to be ready for him?"
"I mean about that house next door. I wanted to plan out how to tell him, you know, to kind of ease into it so he wouldn't fly off the handle. But I ended up just telling him straight out as soon as he got in the door, and now you won't believe what he's doing."
Knowing Mr. J.D. Pickens, P.I., as I did,
I probably would. He had a mind and a will of his own, both of which I had come up against on a few occasions. Recalling some of those, I was almost afraid to ask. What's he doing, Hazel Marie?
He's building, like, a fence or something. That's what he says he's doing. Except from what he just had delivered and stacked in our driveway, I think it's going to be a wall. He's even got a surveyor out here, and on a Saturday morning, too, to make sure of the line. Miss Julia, he's got a load of concrete blocks for the posts and a stack of boards almost as high as the garage sitting out there, and he's got two men mixing cement. I don't know where we're going to park or what the neighbor's going to say, but he's like a crazy man. Can't you talk some sense into him? We just need to give Binky a little more time. He says he's taking no chances on those little hellions messing with our girls. And Miss Julia, it's going to be 6 feet high, or even higher. He's not sure yet. And you won't believe this, but he's planning to build another fence on Jan Osborne's side. He's already talked to her. So the Cochrane house will be fenced in on both sides, and he's talked Mr. Pickerel into letting him extend it across the back. The Cochrane house will be practically enclosed, and you know it doesn't have much of a yard in the first place.
Well, as long as he makes sure he's not building on the Cochrane lot, there's not much they can do about it. And maybe a fence will make them understand how unwelcome they are in the neighborhood. I wouldn't worry about it, Hazel Marie. You have the nicest yard on the block, and a fence can only improve on it.
A nice rail fence would be one thing, she said in resignation, or even a picket fence, but what he's planning is more like the Great Wall of China. Of course, I should be thankful that's all he's doing, because his first thought was to build a shooting range out there.
I had a wild urge to laugh, but I refrained. Just plant a nice row of shrubs or trees, or both, on your side, Hazel Marie, and maybe a flowering vine to cover it.
Or what about planting some pyracantha and espaliering it on the fence or the wall or whatever it is? That would be lovely.
J.D. says he's planting kudzu, and you know that stuff will cover anything, including cars. We may wake up one morning and find our house buried in it. Oh, Hazel Marie, surely not. But think of this. It could be trained to cover the Cochrane house. I was teasing, of course, but it was a fact that kudzu had to be carefully watched. It had a way of growing stealthily and getting away from you. But better a crop of kudzu than what I had feared would be Mr. Pickens's reaction to his possible new neighbors. And that was that he would sell Sam's old house and move his family, including Lloyd, to no telling where. As far as I was concerned, he could build whatever he wanted, including a concrete wall with barbed wire on top, as long as they stayed right where they were. Chapter 13. On Sunday morning, Lloyd and I went to church, but I could have stayed home with Ronnie for all the good it did me. I was a little leery about leaving him alone in the first place, but we'd made sure to close all the kitchen doors so he couldn't wander through the house. He seemed well pleased with the snug corner that Lillian had made for him, and well he should have been, for she'd provided him with an old 300-thread-count comforter to curl up on. We entered the church, took our places in the fourth row from the front on the side aisle, and prepared to hear another movie review from Pastor Rucker. I'd said nothing to Lloyd about my dissatisfaction with our new pastor, but he was sharp enough to know the difference between a biblical text and a line from Star Wars. If I heard Pastor Rucker start off with, "A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, one more time," I'd wish that's where he was. Actually, though, it hadn't mattered what the sermon topic was. Not a word the pastor uttered entered my head. He'd done me in during the announcement time right before the sermon when he'd urged the congregation to put the Homes for Teens on their prayer lists because the sponsors were having trouble with non-compliant neighbors and the zoning board.
"My friends," he'd said, "there are 200 homeless teenagers in this county, and it's not only shameful, it's a public disgrace to allow any child to wonder where he will sleep at night. I've been deeply saddened to learn that there is resistance from the neighbors of the house chosen for a few of these homeless children. That resistance is a result of unfounded fears that result in a lack of Christian compassion, and they need our prayers." It was all I could do to continue sitting there. I wanted to stand up and ask why his, not one but two, guest rooms were empty last night. But my rigorous bent against creating a scene kept me rooted to my pew. I was, however, steaming inside, and he could have preached on the film version of 50 Shades of Grey, and I wouldn't have heard a word. As soon as the last note of the recessional sounded and the last choir member was out the door, I grabbed Lloyd's arm and headed toward the back. I knew it was best that I avoid the pastor as he stood in the narthex shaking hands. I might have been tempted to ring his off. But the idea, the very idea that concern for the welfare of one's own children, as well as of one's property values, was indicative of a lack of Christian compassion, was self-righteousness run amok. Ronnie's delight, however, on our return to the house distracted me from such troubling thoughts. He went first to Lloyd, then turned his attention to me, sniffing appreciatively as he waited patiently, it seemed, for another ear rub. Another good thing about having a dog the size of Ronnie, you could pet him without stooping over. The ear medications were doing what they were supposed to, for he had a little more life to him. Lloyd hooked Ronnie's leash to his collar and walked him around the yard while I got out the makings of lunch. Since Sam was away, I was giving Lillian more paid days off than usual, although she rarely came in on Sundays anyway. "Let's go see what J.D.'s doing," Lloyd said as we ate egg salad sandwiches. "I didn't see them at church, so Betty's working on that fence. If it's all right with you, I want to help him this afternoon." "There was a time, you know, when no work at all was done on Sundays," I said, "unless one's ox was in the ditch. But after what we heard in church this morning, I think Mr. Pickens's ox is mired in deep. Let's both go. Change your clothes, though, if you're going to help." Thinking that Ronnie could use an outing, we took him with us, although I worried about his sensitive stomach. But it was only 4 blocks to the Pickens house, so I counted on his ability to control his gag reflex until we got there. The Pickens's yard looked like an anthill. Stacks of lumber, cement mixers, stakes with string outlining the area, 2 men carrying concrete blocks, another man laying them down, James bringing water, the 2 little girls standing aside to watch, and Mr. Pickens, unshaven and sweaty, in full directing mode. My word, but the man was muscular. It was a clear but nippy October day, yet his T-shirt clung wetly to his body. I couldn't help but notice, for even his mustache dripped with perspiration. He managed a brief smile when we got out of the car at curbside. There was no room in their driveway. "Hey, bud," he said to Lloyd, "where'd you get that horse?" Lloyd laughed. "He's our house guest for a few days." "Well," Mr. Pickens said, "if you come to help, I sure can use you. Miss Julia," he said, turning to me, "what do you think of my fence?" I surveyed the area, seeing only 5 tall but stout towers of concrete blocks spaced along the surveyor's string, with a 6th one under construction. I said. "So far, so good, I guess. What will you put between the posts?" "Horizontal boards of treated lumber 6 feet high, and so close together that not even a beam of light can get through. There'll be no peeping Toms on my watch."
"Well, that sounds lovely," I said, because there are times when it's better to be diplomatic than truthful. "I'll just go in and visit with Hazel Marie a while."
The little Pickens twins, Lily May and Julie, had raced to pet Ronnie as soon as he jumped out of the car, and he seemed to love the attention. He looked, in fact, more like his old self, his head held high, his tail wagging as the little girls made a fuss over him as if he'd been a rock star. Lloyd took his leash and led him to a ringside seat next to the house where he could watch the activity. The little girls sat with him, cooing and talking to him, rubbing their hands over him, and Ronnie regally permitted it. He watched with bright, interested eyes everything that was going on. What a difference from the sick and ailing dog of 2 days before, thanks to modern canine medicine. Hazel Marie, looking stressed and worried, met me at the front door.
"Oh, Miss Julia, how awful do you think it'll look?"
"I think it'll be fine." I followed her into the living room where we took our seats. "I wouldn't worry about how it looks, Hazel Marie. Anybody would do the same thing if faced with what you're facing. Have any of your neighbors complained?"
"No. Actually, they've come around offering J.D. advice, but you know how he is. He's going to do it his way no matter what. I'm so glad we're on a corner lot. At least we won't be fenced in like the Cochran house will be."
"Have any of those people said anything, made any complaints about being closed in on three sides?"
"No, but J.D. hopes they will."
Hazel Marie pushed back her hair and sighed.
"He's just waiting to tell them what he thinks."
"Well, let's hope they have enough sense to steer clear of him. But listen, Hazel Marie, I hate to bring this up, but I wouldn't care if he built an iron curtain out there and staffed it with armed guards. I'm just so afraid that he'll decide you should sell this house and move."
"Oh, he's thought of it, and it worries me to death. I love this house. I don't ever want to move."
She looked around the room as if appreciating anew its perfect proportions.
"Somebody's already asked if we were interested in selling."
"Who?"
"I don't know. It was a while back, and J.D. just laughed because this house means a lot to him."
Hazel Marie stopped, then said,
"He's not laughing now."
"Well, then, encourage him about the fence. I wouldn't complain about whatever he wants to do if it'll keep you here."
"You're right. I should, and I will. Because if the fence doesn't work, he'll want to move. Probably 10 miles out on 100 acres so he doesn't have to worry about what the neighbors do."
"Remind him that you would be out of the city school district and your girls would have to ride the bus, and that Lloyd would want to stay and graduate from the city high school. And remind him how far you'd have to drive just to go to the grocery store."
"And me by myself out in the woods somewhere when he's going on a case? I couldn't stand that, Miss Julia."
"I know, I couldn't either. But I wouldn't say anything to him right now."
"Be thinking, though, of all the reasons that moving would be a bad idea, just in case. And remember this, Binky is still working on it. We've not exhausted all the legal aspects yet."
"That's about the only thing that keeps me going."
"Well, let me get up from here," I said, rising. "Ronnie is about due for another dose of his medicine, so we need to get home."
We walked out into the side yard, where at first I didn't see Ronnie, although I saw his leash lying on the ground. "Oh, my," I said, thinking of having to tell Thurlow that I'd lost his dog.
"Help me look for Ronnie, Hazel Marie. I might have to move out of town myself if I've let him get away."
She walked around the stack of lumber, then said,
"He's over here, Miss Julia. Come look."
I hurried around the pile of lumber to see Ronnie spread out full length on the grass, on full alert, his eyes bright and shining as he watched every move that Mr. Pickens made. In fact, even as we watched, Ronnie inched a little closer as Mr. Pickens put another concrete block, heavily mudded, onto the post he was building.
"Hazel Marie," I said, "I've always heard that dogs are attracted to children, but that is obviously a man's dog. I think Mr. Pickens has just taken Thurlow's place in Ronnie's estimation."
"Miss Julia, it's Binky."
The phone had just rung as I'd walked into the kitchen the next morning, stopping me on my way to the coffee pot.
"Oh, good morning, Binky. You're at the office awfully early today."
"Just wanted you to know that the zoning board sent a letter Friday to the Board of the Homes for Teens. They should get it in the mail today. They're being notified that their request for a permit to open a residential group home in that area has been denied. Their stated purpose doesn't meet the legal requirements for that area.
Really? Oh, Binky, that's wonderful news. Thank you, thank you.
I was so relieved I had to sit down. What do you think they'll do now? I mean, can they ask for a waiver or something?
Sure, they can, and if they do, it'll go to the county commissioners, who will hold a hearing.
The neighbors will be notified by letter when the hearing will be held, and they can publicly register their opposition.
I want you to speak for me, Binky, so if we get a letter about a hearing, you be ready. The zoning board's feet should be held to the fire, and I want them to stick to their original ruling.
I'll stay on it, she promised, and I hung up with joy in my heart. Those people would move their homeless home, and Hazel Marie and her family would not move anywhere.
It was later that same day that the phone rang again. Pastor Rucker wanted to know if I could meet with him and Madge that evening.
I would be delighted to meet with you both, I told him.
The fact of the matter was that I couldn't wait to hear Madge admit that the Homes for Teens Board of Directors had not done their homework. They had spent donated money on a house that did not and would not qualify for their planned use.
Actually, to tell the truth, I wanted to see Madge taken down several pegs, and I wanted an apology for being called immoral in the newspaper. Simply because I thought the zoning ordinances ought to be upheld. I knew I'd probably get neither, but I wasn't above wanting a little recognition for being right.
The town should thank me. Who knew when another residential area would be invaded?
With that perfectly understandable feeling of justification, I set out to walk to the church after supper, even though this late in October it was already dark. Lloyd had offered to walk over with me, but I knew he'd have to sit around and wait in Norma's office.
No, honey, I'd said. You have homework and I'll be all right. All the street lights are on and I'll leave the porch light on.
Then take your cell phone, he said, and call me when you leave the church. I'll wait on the porch and watch out for you.
So I hurried across the street and into the church, eager to have it out with Madge and her sidekick, the pastor.
I knocked lightly on the pastor's office door. Then turned the handle. Madge was already there, and it seemed to me that she had been there for some while. The room had the feel of a lot of talk between the two of them, which wouldn't have surprised me one bit. That Home for Teens group had been involved in underhanded activities from the very beginning.
"Ah, come in, Miss Julia," Pastor Rucker stood and motioned me to the chair in front of his desk.
Madge sat in a chair drawn up close to his so that they were both facing me, like a board of inquisition.
"We were just discussing this discouraging letter from the zoning board. Have you heard about it?"
"Yes, my attorney notified me today."
"Oh, Julia," Madge said, her voice dripping with false sympathy. "I'm so sorry you felt that you had to pay an attorney. We could have worked this out together."
I put a steady gaze on Madge, letting her know that I was not intimidated by her overbearing reputation. She was a firmly packed woman, slightly pudgy but not too much so, with a short, easily kept hairdo in need of color and wearing no-nonsense clothes as if she were too burdened by the needs of others to see to herself. What ran me up a wall, though, was the air of overweening confidence about her. As who wouldn't have if they knew they were never wrong, but the woman was known to have flights of fancy about what should be done, usually by others. If it were up to her, there would be non-profit organizations fully staffed by sensitive progressive thinkers holding forth in focus groups on every street corner in town.
"Possibly," I said, acknowledging the partial truth of her words, "but only if you had let us know what you were doing before you went ahead and did it."
"Well," she said with a great sigh, "it's so disappointing. So many young boys are in such need, and they're at just the age to go down the wrong trail."
"Yes, that's exactly what the neighbors are concerned about. But, Madge, surely you can find a more suitable place to have your group home. I mean, just because it won't work on Jackson Street doesn't mean that you have to give up entirely. I'm sorry that you'll have to move from the house you have and look for another place, but better that than just giving up.
Oh, we aren't giving up, I assure you. We are fully committed and feel sure that the Lord wants us to continue on.
Well, I said, sitting back complacently, with his leading, I'm sure you'll find the perfect place.
But, Madge, you really should look into the zoning ordinances and all the other requirements before you sink your money into something else. It doesn't speak well of the leadership of your board to have made a mistake of this magnitude.
I couldn't agree more, Madge said with a pleasant smile on her face as she glanced at the pastor, who was also smiling.
We are, even now, in the process of regrouping. The house on Jackson Street isn't zoned for a residential group home, but that's not what we are.
No, we are now rewording our mission statement to reflect our intent to be a foster care home instead, and we are assured that a foster care home needs no permit at all.
With a lurch, I felt as if the bottom had just fallen out. No wonder they were smiling. They were busily working around the regulations and getting what they wanted by a sleight of hand in what they called themselves. Lord help us all from self-righteous and determined do-gooders.
Chapter 14. Feeling thoroughly defeated and victoriously crowed over, I hurried home along the dark sidewalk, completely forgetting to call Lloyd. Didn't even occur to me, a lone woman at night, to fear being accosted, grabbed, or mugged. In fact, I would have welcomed a physical confrontation in which I could let loose my frustration by way of my heavily laden pocketbook. Just try it, I thought. I'll smack you to kingdom come. All of which was ridiculous. Abbotsville was a safe town, and my well-lit house was only a few steps away. Nevertheless, I hurried inside, locked the door behind me, and turned off the porch light. Calling upstairs to Lloyd to let him know I was safely home, I went to the library and called Binky.
Binky, I said, trying to catch my breath. Binky, you won't believe what they're doing now.
Oh, forgive me. I know you're busy with little Gracie, and I should have waited until tomorrow when you're in the office. But, Binky, they've made an end run on us, and they're still in business.
Who, Miss Julia? What are you talking about?
Those homes for teens, people. The bane of my existence. Binky, if we don't do something about them, they're going to run Hazel Marie and her family completely out of town, and I can't stand the thought of that.
Okay, calm down. Tell me what they're doing.
Well, I said with a great sigh, it seems they're changing their stated purpose, but they're not changing what they're doing. Not one iota. Instead of being a residential group home, which Madge Taylor admits is not permitted, they are now going to be a foster care home. It's nothing but semantics, Binky, calling the same thing by another name in order to get around the law. And I am so angry I don't know what to do.
A foster care home, Binky said softly, as if thinking it through. I'll double-check in the morning, but I don't think a foster care home would qualify either, not with one or two so-called parents and a half-dozen foster children. I'll look into it and let you know. So I had to be satisfied with that. But I was not comforted by it. Wait and I'll let you know. Wait and we'll see. Wait and it'll work out. I was to sit and wait while those arrogant scufflaws breezed on doing whatever they wanted to do. What arrogance! And all in the name of doing good, and all who disagreed with them were void of Christian compassion. It was more than I could cope with, yet that's what I had to do. First thing, though, was not to tell Hazel Marie and Mr. Pickens, at least until the changed designation was made known publicly. They would know soon enough that the work on the Cochran house was ongoing.
Miss Julia? I looked around to see Lloyd coming into the library, and it unsettled me to realize I'd been so caught up in my own thoughts that I'd not heard him.
Oh, Lloyd. Sorry, honey. I was a million miles away. Did you finish your homework?
Yes'm, but I wanted to tell you that Mr. Sam called. He's in France, and he said to tell you that he's fine, and he'll call back maybe tomorrow. Oh, my goodness, and I missed him. Did you tell him where I was?
Just that you had a meeting at the church.
Well, good. I'd as soon not worry him with what we're contending with here. Oh, my. I hate that I missed him tonight. I'll probably sit by the phone all day tomorrow.
Soon after dosing Ronnie's infected ears, which were looking and smelling much better, at 10 o'clock I went to bed, knowing that my roiling mind would keep sleep far at bay. Actually, it didn't, and I woke the following morning having slept fairly well. Uncharacteristically lingering there in my lonely bed, I ran over in my mind all that was facing me in the coming day. First and foremost was to think of a way to foil Madge Taylor's intent to avoid the zoning laws. A letter to the editor? No, that would instigate a spate of letters pointing out my lack of pity for homeless children, if the paper would print mine in the first place. They reserved the right to refuse letters that didn't suit the editor's stance. Maybe I could strengthen the resolve of the neighbors by having a meeting and facing down the board of the Homes for Teens with a board of our own. Or maybe I should suggest that Hazel Marie begin to look for another house. One in a town with a large yard that would suit Mr. Pickens. But, Lord, I hated to do that. It would be just giving up and letting Madge have her way, giving everybody a lesson in how to successfully avoid obeying the law. And there was an idea. Maybe I could report Madge to the Internal Revenue Service. If she flouted the law in one area, maybe she did in others as well. But, of course, I wouldn't do that. No need to draw the attention of the IRS to either a reportee or a reporter. Namely me. Mildred Allen, my friend and next-door neighbor, I should have already thought of her. When Mildred spoke, people generally listened, especially because, unlike me, she rarely threw her weight around. So when she did, she made a great impact. Of course, I wouldn't word it exactly like that to her, as she carried a lot of weight not only in financial terms, but in number of pounds as well. So I got up, dressed, and faced the day with a heavy heart. Madge was determined to plunge ahead, and I'd seen her reduce a city commissioner to a red-faced, cowering blob when he dared vote against renaming a local street for Mother Teresa. "Ronnie," I said, meeting the huge dog as he lumbered up the stairs, "we are lined up against a steamroller of the first order." "Woof," he said, turning to follow me down. Lillian looked up as we entered the kitchen.
"I already doctored his ears and took him outside. I figured if you wasn't up, you needed the sleep."
"Thank you, Lillian. I guess I did. Too much on my mind, I suppose. You haven't heard from Helen Stroud, have you?"
"No. I'll tell you when somebody calls."
"Oh, I know. It's just that I don't know how long she expects us to keep Ronnie. I thought she'd at least call and ask about him, or Thurlow would."
"Maybe," she said darkly. "Mr. Thurlow can't get to no telephone. If they don't put one right next to him, he'll be out of luck."
"Oh, Lillian, don't put such notions in my head. I'm worried enough about him and everybody else, too." Our own telephone rang then, and I'd still not had my first cup of coffee. So, unfortified, I answered it. "Julia," Luann Conover sang out, much too perkily, "let's have lunch. Are you free?" "Oh, I've just been thinking of you, Luann," I said, only half truthfully, although I'd given her untold amounts of thinking time in the past. Having finally gotten the gumption to strike out on her own, Luann had only recently set up housekeeping as a single woman. "I'm so glad you called. And yes, let's do have lunch and catch up with each other. Where and when?"
"Let's go to the tea room. They serve light lunches, and I'm watching my weight. Let's aim for 11:30. They fill up fast."
Luann always looked well put together. She never left home without makeup, carefully done hair, and appropriate clothing, whether she was going to a garden club meeting or to the grocery store. And that day was no exception, except she looked even better than usual. She was already seated at a table for two by a window when I arrived right on time. The first thing I noticed was the bright, fresh look on her face, and the second thing I noticed was the wine glass in her hand. Whether one was the cause of the other, I couldn't tell, but the glass unnerved me. For as long as I'd known her, which was ever since I'd come to Abbotsville as a bride, Lou Anne had been a teetotaler. Now here she was, sipping away in public. Seating myself across from her and slipping off my coat, I said, "Luann, you look marvelous. How you doing?"
"Thank you, Julia. I feel marvelous. I've just about gotten my, or rather, Helen's condo arranged to my liking, and I'm all unpacked. And, Julia, I'll tell you the truth. I don't know why in the world you married a second time."
"Well," I said with a surprised laugh, "because Sam came along, that's why."
"He's a good one, I agree. But once you had a taste of doing exactly what you wanted, when you wanted, with no one expecting one thing from you, it's a wonder you were willing to give that up."
Uncomfortable with the way the conversation was going, I said, "It sounds as if you'd really adjusted to single life, and if so, I'm glad."
"You should be. I'm not only adjusted, I'm happier than I've ever been. I should have left Leonard years ago. Julia, it is such a joy to get up when I want to, eat when I want to, and watch what I want to watch on television. Now, I admit that Leonard was a very quiet person. Why, lots of times I hardly knew he was in the house. But it's very different knowing that no one is there, and that I'm not going to be asked what we're having for supper."
"I imagine so. Let's order. Do you know what you're having for lunch?"
"A refill of this, for one thing," she said, tilting her wine glass. "Have one with me, Julia."
"No, I'll stick with coffee. A glass of wine would put me to sleep for the afternoon." Actually, I was shocked at Luann's consumption of alcohol. It made me wonder if she drank alone in that companionless condo she was reveling in. Luann had only recently left her husband of more than 40 years, after learning that for 30 of them, he'd been having an affair with one Totsy somebody. Even so, she'd been able to leave only because an ideal place to live quite economically came open. Helen Stroud's condo when she'd moved into Thurlow's house to take care of him. Even Luann could think of no excuse to stay with a faithless husband when the Lord had so conveniently provided a way out for her.
"Well," Luann said after we'd ordered our salads, "as much as I'm enjoying the solitary life, and I mean that, Julia, I do occasionally miss having somebody to talk to. I'm thinking of getting a dog. That would be close to having Leonard around. Neither would answer back."
With Luann, one never knew when she was being serious, but I couldn't help but laugh. "Well, I can tell you who might need a home."
"Who?"
"Ronnie. Remember him? Thurlow's dog?" And I went on to tell her how Ronnie had come to be a semi-permanent guest in my home, and also hint a little about my concern for Thurlow.
"Well, first off, I don't have room for a Great Dane. And second off,"
Luann leaned forward to whisper, "do you really think Helen is robbing Thurlow?"
"No. No, I don't. But Thurlow does, and that's almost as bad."
Luann leaned back in her chair with a look of consternation on her face.
"You're right. Even if he only thinks so, he could fire her. And where would I be then? She'd want her condo back, and I'd be on the street. And just when I was really coming to love being settled by myself. I've even got a part-time job lined up, answering the phone, which I can do in my sleep. Oh, Julia, I wish you hadn't told me. Now I'm going to worry myself sick."
"Don't, Luann, because that's not going to happen.
I'm sure Helen has foreseen just such a possibility. She has Thurlow locked in securely and legally, believe me.
The only one I'm concerned about is Ronnie, because he's used to being treated like a member of the family, and Helen has relegated him to a pen in the backyard.
Why don't you keep him?
I may have to, I said, sighing. Except then I'd have to build a fence.
But speaking of fences, and I went on to tell her about the Great Wall of China going up along the Pickens' side yard. Chapter 15.
I'll tell you what let's do,
Luann said, cutting off my intention to enlist her help in taking Madge Taylor down. She sat up straight as her eyes brightened with a sudden idea.
Let's drop in on Helen and visit with Thurlow. She asked me if I wanted a lease, and...
You don't have a lease?
No. I saw no reason to go to the trouble. Helen and I are friends, you know.
Oh, my, Luann, that's all the more reason to have one.
Casual agreements between friends can lead to future problems.
Just tell her that you'd be more comfortable keeping things legal between the two of you, and emphasize that it's for her protection as the owner of the condo.
Well, I guess you know what you're talking about with all the rental property you have. It's a shame, though, that friends can't trust each other.
It's not a matter of trust, I said. It's a matter of letting you sleep at night without worrying about a sudden eviction notice if Helen changes her mind.
You're right,
Luann said, for once listening to my advice.
I'd be up a creek if Helen wanted her condo back. It's really the only worry on my mind. And I'll tell you, Julia, I did not know how burdened I was in my marriage until I got out of it. And I'm not talking about Leonard's dalliance with that Totsy woman. I'm talking about years and years of just plain incompatibility, and I didn't even know what was causing my inner turmoil until I was rid of it. It was him all along. Now, she said, taking another sip from her glass, I'm feeling compatible with just about everybody.
I pulled the car to the curb in front of Thurlow's house, got out, and waited on the sidewalk for Luann to park behind me.
My word, she said as she walked over to me. The place is certainly looking better than I've ever seen it. I rarely drove by here, but when I did, I always thought it looked like a haunted house.
Wait till you see the inside, I said, unlatching the gate and leading the way to the front door. Thurlow has apparently given Helen a free hand, or, more likely, given into her demand for a free hand. Not that I blame her. Nobody, and certainly not Helen, as particular as she is, could have lived in such squalor. Now, Luann, I said, as we approached the freshly painted front door, let me suggest that if you mention a lease to Helen, you do it as subtly as you can. Put it as protection for her, in that it will spell out your responsibilities and caring for her condo.
Oh, of course, Julia, she said a little testily. I'm not at a complete loss when it comes to such things, you know.
I wasn't so sure about that, but I'd given all the advice she wanted to hear.
I rang the doorbell, then asked to be announced to Mrs. Stroud when the maid answered the door. We were shown into the morning room, and while Helen was informed of our visit, Luann looked around in amazement.
"This is gorgeous," she whispered. "She's restoring it to its original state. Only I'm not sure it ever looked this good. Every club in town will want it on their house tour."
Then, in an even lower tone, she said,
"I think I'm safe, Julia. Helen will never leave something like this."
Then in came Helen herself, a welcoming but somewhat strained smile on her face.
"How nice to see you both," she said. "Do have a seat. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, but there's so much to oversee with construction going on."
"We apologize for just dropping in, Helen," I said. "And we can't stay but a minute. We know you're busy, but just thought we'd see how Thurlow is. He must be anxious for news about Ronnie."
"That's thoughtful of you, because he is eager to hear how Ronnie's doing. I have never in my life known a man so attached to an animal."
She stood, then said, "Let's walk upstairs, and if you'll excuse me, I'll just leave you with him while I get back to selecting the flooring for the kitchen."
"Well, that'll be fine," I said, rising too. "We'll visit for a few minutes, then see ourselves out."
So far, Luann had barely said a word, and she didn't on our way up the stairs, her head swiveling around so much that she almost tripped on the painter's drop cloth on the top step.
But as we walked across the landing to Thurlow's room, she said, "Helen, my lawyer says that we need a lease on the condo, and I hope you won't think it's because I'm afraid you want it back, because after seeing this, I'm sure you won't. But, well, just in case, so I won't worry about being evicted. Would you mind signing one?"
As my eyes rolled so far back in my head that I was afraid they'd never straighten out, Helen smiled her serene smile and said,
"Of course. Send me two copies. We'll both sign them and each keep one. How long a lease would you like? 1 year? Two? Or maybe five?
Whatever you want, because there's always the danger that you might move and leave me with an empty condo. It'll be a relief to know that I'll have rent coming in for as long as the lease is in effect, whether you're in it or not."
A look of sudden dismay swept over Luann's face at the realization that a lease worked both ways.
"What do you think, Julia?" she asked.
"Oh, I don't know. What about 3 years with an option to renew? And also first refusal if Helen decides to put it on the market. That should give you both some reassurance as well as some breathing room."
"Perfect," Helen said as she tapped on Thurlow's bedroom door.
"If that suits you, Luann, we'll get it done."
Then she said, "Please don't stay long. He's quite excitable and gets upset if he has too much stimulation."
Well, they, Lord, I thought, the last thing on my mind was stimulating Thurlow Jones. He's generated enough of that all by himself.
"Look who's come to see you," Helen said as we trooped into Thurlow's room. "It's Julia and Luann. Do you feel like a little visit?"
Thurlow was in bed, propped up by pillows, his temporarily useless legs spread out under a sheet. He gave us a dismissive glance from under his thatch of white hair and white eyebrows, then snapped his fingers at the muscular T-shirted man on the other side of the bed.
"Mac," he said, "up to,"
and the man immediately drew up two chairs for us.
"Well, ladies," Thurlow said in his typically challenging way, "what lured you from your tea parties to visit the sick and ailing, or the lost and lonely, or the dead and dying?"
"Christian compassion," I shot back at him, "and not one thing more." As sick as he looked with patches of red on his cheeks, I was encouraged by the sharpness of his tone and the usual belittling comment he'd flung at us.
"Ha!" he came back at me quickly enough. "Glad to see you ain't lost your spirit in spite of marrying Sam Murdoch."
Then he glowered at me from under those bushy eyebrows. "Where's my dog?"
"Ronnie is lying on a 300-thread count comforter in a corner of my kitchen. He's been getting eardrops every 4 hours. He's being walked and driven around and played with by Lloyd and the Pickens twins. He's been overseeing some yard work that Mr. Pickens is doing, and he's being fed by the best cook in town. In other words, Thurlow, Ronnie is in dog heaven and thoroughly enjoying your recuperation."
"Well, I don't want you spoiling him." Thurlow turned his face away, then mumbled, "He won't get any of that here."
"He has another few days for the eardrops," I said. "Would you like me to bring him home then?"
Instead of answering, Thurlow said to his minder,
"Mac, get up from there and get these ladies something to drink, some coffee. That'd be good. And I want some too."
Luann leaned forward, her mouth open to say something like we couldn't stay, but I held her back, shaking my head. As soon as Mike left the room, looking back at us as he did so, Thurlow pushed himself farther up in the bed.
"Whatever she tells you," he said in a hoarse whisper, "don't believe it. She aims to get rid of my dog one way or the other,
so don't believe anything she says.
Then, even though I'd been watching for it, his hand snaked out as quick as a flash and grabbed my arm.
She's gonna leave him in that backyard pen to freeze to death this winter. That's her plan.
Listen, he said, shaking my arm. I'll pay you, Lady Murdoch. I'll pay you to keep him for me. She thinks she's got it all, but she don't know everything.
Hearing Mike hurrying up the stairs, Thurlow released my arm, but not before giving it a hard squeeze to underline his plea. Panting, Mike strode in, saying that the maid was perking coffee and would bring it up in a few minutes. It was clear to me that Mike had his orders about leaving Thurlow alone.
"I don't think we can stay for coffee, but thank you anyway," I said, getting to my feet. "And Thurlow, don't worry about Ronnie. He's well settled for the time being. He misses you, I'm sure, but he's enjoying his vacation with us."
Then, as quickly as we could, Luann and I said our farewells and got out of there, down the stairs and out the door without disturbing Helen's floor selection process.
"Julia?" Luann said as we neared our cars. "He scared me to death. What do you think is going on in that house?"
"I don't know, but it worries me, too. Either he's being thoroughly taken advantage of, or he's feeding us a bunch of wild stories, whichever it is, though. It looks as if I'm stuck with Ronnie for the duration."
Chapter 16. When Sam called that afternoon, it was all I could do to keep from begging him to come home. With his fine legal mind and his ability to calmly assess a situation, he could both explain our options to foil the plans for the Cochran house and tell us how to carry them out as well. Instead, though, I said not one word of the turmoil we were dealing with, in spite of recalling the old saying that you can't fight City Hall, and thinking that Sam could if he'd come home. That's what I felt we were up against, and not only City Hall, but the city churches as well. Every person in town, except those it directly affected, seemed to think that the specific house chosen for homeless teenage boys was a marvelous thing. And those who were affected were expected to just accept it without a murmur. In fact, to smile about it and keep their mouths shut. In other words, the overriding attitude toward those who were unhappy seemed to be quiet and stop spoiling our delight in how wonderful and selfless and Christian we are. So, I asked Sam about his travels and what he was seeing on his tours, and he told me in great detail about arches, Gothic windows with tracery, buttresses, both flying and non, westworks and ambulatories. He was having a fine time. So I encouraged him to bring home lots of pictures so he could show me exactly what he was talking about. Lord, I missed him. But at the same time, I was glad that he was doing something he'd long wanted to do. So, hanging up the phone without mentioning the plight we were in, I took up my lonely concerns again. When Binky's secretary called and asked if I could come down to the office that afternoon, my spirits immediately soared. At least Binky was working for us, and a meeting implied that she had news. "Binky," I said, sitting forward in the chair in front of her desk, "tell me something good. I badly need some good news." "Sorry, Miss Julia. This is just an update, letting you know where we are at this point. Nothing settled yet, but I've discussed the problem with Janet Bradley, the zoning board administrator, and she tells me that the Board of Homes for Teens applied for a permit several times, each time under a different designation. They've called themselves a residential care home, a family group home, neither of which is permitted, and now they're trying as a foster care home, with the subheading of a single-family dwelling. That, of course, is permitted as far as the zoning regulations are concerned." "But," I started to protest. "I know," she said, holding up her hand. "But here's the final word as far as the zoning goes. Any type of residential care facility in that area is not permitted.
Foster homes are not specifically mentioned, but if the Board of Adjustments interprets foster homes as a type of residential care facility, then clearly the use of that property in that way is not permitted. Now, they may get away with calling themselves a single-family dwelling,